Greetings and salutations, darklings and fanged fiends. We are Chell and Tori. Welcome to the fifth episode of Vampires Ruined My Life.
Tonight, we're discussing the 1998 cinematic masterpiece Blade, based on the Marvel comics. It was written by David S. Goyer and directed by Stephen Norrington. And it was produced by the film star, Wesley Snipes. So we're not going to go through the whole movie scene by scene. We're just going to give a quick summary, and then we're obviously going to discuss it later.
Break it down, girl.
Yeah. So here is the quick movie summary of Blade. A pregnant woman is brought into the ER after being attacked by a vampire. She dies, but the baby lives. Cut to present day. There's a rave going on in some secret, special, like, club. It's like a dance club, and people are dancing, and there's a DJ. And then there's, like, one of those sirens where maybe they're going to drop the foam or something if you're at, like, a foam party. But instead, blood rains down on the crowd. And the crowd is mostly vampires, although there is a human, at least one, who's been brought by a vampire, probably more in the crowd. And then Blade arrives. So vampires flee, but Blade cuts down a lot of them. And then he tells a vampire, Quinn, that he has a message for his boss. So he uses these, like, stiletto things to, like, stake Quinn to the wall and then sets him on fire and burns Quinn to a crisp. But Quinn isn't really dead because vampires in this world can resurrect from pretty much anything except, like, having their heads cut off and stuff. So they're resilient vampires in Blade.
Mm-hmm.
So Quinn is brought to the morgue at the hospital where hematologist Dr. Karen Jensen is noticing something odd about the blood of some of the recent bodies they've received. Unfortunately for her, Quinn wakes up and attacks and bites her neck. Blade arrives to finish the job and kill Quinn, but Quinn gets away. So Blade takes Karen to his hideout where she's treated by his mentor and friend Whistler. They explain about vampires and the war they're waging on the vampire population of the city, and how Blade takes a serum to suppress his bloodlust, but that's losing its effectiveness. And unfortunately for Karen, she probably only has a few days before she turns, because sometimes if you're bitten, you don't turn, but from the looks of her bite, Whistler thinks she's going to turn. There's not really any hope for her. So elsewhere, Vampire Deacon Frost attends a meeting of pureblood vampire elders. He's scolded for his flashy vampire clubs and for turning so many vampires and for drawing unnecessary attention from humans, and of course, from people like Blade. So we find out that turned vampires are seen as lesser, and purebloods who were born vampires are kind of sick of these, like, previously human vampires being all, you know, uppity and wild and causing problems for the vampire world.
It's an allegory for racism.
Sort of, yeah.
That's what Goyer's, like, intention was.
That's funny. I can see that, though. Although it is... yeah, a bunch of white people. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out Frost has a plan. So to start, he has one of the elders killed to help strip them of their authority. Meanwhile, Blade sends Karen home to her apartment where she's attacked by one of Frost's familiars. Blade arrives because he actually shadowed her knowing she would probably be attacked. So he kind of used her as bait in this trap. And he forces the familiar to tell him how to get to an archive where the vampires keep their historical records. There, Blade tortures the vampire to learn that Frost is preparing a ritual where he will awaken the blood god Lamagra, and Blade's blood is actually key to this ritual. Meanwhile, while experimenting with an anticoagulant as a possible replacement for Blade's serum, Karen discovers that it explodes when combined with vampire blood. She also manages to synthesize a vaccine that can cure the infected, but learns that it will not work on Blade or fully turned vampires. So if you've been bitten, you can be cured, but if you're actually a vampire, you're SOL. Karen is confident that she can cure Blade eventually, but it's going to take years of time and research. Frost and his men then attack the hideout. They infect Whistler and abduct Karen. When Blade returns, he helps Whistler shoot himself to avoid becoming a vampire. Then Blade goes to Frost's penthouse because he's trying to rescue Karen, and he discovers a woman, Vanessa, in Frost's room. Turns out, Vanessa is his mother. She came back as a vampire after she quote-unquote died. And Frost was the vampire who attacked her. Reveal. Blade, I am your father. Anyway,
He is not, by the way.
No, he's not. And Blade is then subdued and taken to the Temple of Eternal Night, where Frost plans to perform the summoning ritual for Lamagra, which involves killing 12 purebloods. Karen is thrown into a pit to be devoured by her former coworker, who was also transformed into a vampire during Quinn's attack. And he's also like not in a good vampire state, so he's kind of like a decomposing zombie-like vampire.
Like a revenant.
Yeah. And Karen actually manages to escape because she's resourceful. Meanwhile, for the ritual, Blade is drained of his blood in this weird contraption thing. But then he gets out of there. Karen helps him get out. And Karen also allows him to drink from her, enabling him to kind of recover because he can recover some of his lost blood.
I think it was like an Iron Maiden.
Yeah. Yeah. Where he was like strapped in and then like little needles came out.
Yeah. It was like a reverse Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
Because it was specifically to drain, not just to like spike you and because like his blood flowed into like a divot,
right, where it would like come out at the right spots for the ritual. Mm-hmm. Which I
like a drain.
And we could talk about this later, maybe, or maybe not, but like basically it's hilarious to me that the purebloods have this like ancient prophecy ritual thing in this like building that they've designed that requires killing like 12 purebloods and using a daywalker to like, I don't know, it just seems like a weird thing for them to even have, but that's okay. We can't think about it too hard or it won't make sense. Mm-mm. So Blade confronts Frost after killing all of his minions, including Vanessa, his mother. And during their fight, Blade injects Frost with all of the syringes, which contain the vampire exploding juice, and it causes his body to inflate and explode and kills him. Because even though he's summoned Lamagra, the blood god, into him, his blood is not immune to that stuff that Karen created. So yay.
Yay, science.
Yay, science. So Karen actually offers to help Blade cure himself. Like she'll go home and try and find this cure for him. But instead, he asks her to create an improved version of the serum so he can continue his crusade against vampires. And then we get a brief epilogue of him in Moscow confronting a vampire and being a badass. And that is Blade.
So in the original ending, Frost turns into Lamagra and becomes this horrifically computer-generated jello monster. The crew was already doubtful going in that this was going to work, but decided to go forward with it despite their misgivings. But the test audiences were all completely mentally checked out and totally lost interest the moment Stephen Dorff, the actor, turned into this gelatinous CGI tornado.
Yeah, I 100% feel like I saw this because like I actually remembered that being the ending instead of the ending that we saw, which is very similar. Like he does kind of blow up into like a thing and explode when he's injected with the serum.
Yeah, but yeah.
I remember the like tornado of like Blood God. And so I think it was like a DVD alternate ending or something that I must have seen.
Probably.
So I definitely had that in my brain.
So let's talk about Blade going from its original comic origins to the big screen. The character of Blade was created by Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan. He first appeared in Tomb of Dracula number 10 in 1973. He actually went against the comic book code of the time because in the comic book code, very explicitly, it stated no vampires. So I'm assuming that Tomb of Dracula did not have the comic book code's like seal of approval. So they were renegades. Just like Blade. So Blade was one of several vampire hunters in that comic anthology. His aesthetic was based on a white vision of blaxploitation movies. And he wore a bright green coat, purple holster full of stakes, yellow glasses, like goggles kind of, and blue pants. Like his creators were white men.
Yes.
So just know that.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, he's been written by white men pretty much all the time. So
yeah, including this movie.
Yes, yeah.
So thankfully, Wesley Snipes had a lot of input. So Blade appeared again in Marvel's short-lived Night Stalker series, where he headed up a few story arcs. So I'm gonna give like a quick backstory on Eric Brooks, aka Blade. So this backstory takes place on Earth 616. Earth 616 in the Marvel Universe is the main universe.
Right.
So in the original comics, Eric Brooks was born in a brothel in the Soho neighborhood of London, England on October 24th, 1929 to Tara Brooks, a sex worker at Madame Vanity's brothel, which was later retconned to include some paternity and Tara's not quite a sex worker, but I'm not going to go into that because that retconned history came after the Blade film. So when Tara experienced severe labor complications, a doctor was called. In actuality, the doctor was the vampire Deacon Frost, who killed Tara by drinking all of her blood. However, this inadvertently passed along certain vampire enzymes to her baby son as he was born. Eric thus became part vampire, also called a dampier or daywalker, preventing him from being turned by a vampire's bite. Tara's fellow sex workers drove off Frost once they realized what he had done, which is amazing. And Eric was subsequently raised in the brothel by all of his loving aunties. And that's the sweetest thing ever. So cute. At age 9, as he was returning home from school one day, Eric saw an old man being attacked by 3 vampires. Eric helped the man, whose name is Jamal Afari, distract his attackers so that he could kill them with a silver sword. Afari, a jazz musician and vampire hunter, soon became a father figure to Eric, teaching him music and training him in the ways of fighting vampires. Eric was soon able to defeat many of the weak younger vampires that he and Afari found in abundance. Over time, the young man became an Olympic-level athlete and a formidable hand-to-hand combatant. His skills with knives and daggers was such that it earned him the nickname Blade among both his fellow hunters and the vampires they opposed, who began to fear him.
Ooh.
Ooh. So that is the basic Earth 616 history of Eric Brooks, aka Blade. He also appears throughout the multiverse, like Earth 12041, which is the 2010s Marvel animated universe, Earth 13122, which is the Marvel Lego universe, and of course, Earth 26320, which encompasses the Blade trilogy and subsequent television show. By contrast, the movie crafted the character around Wesley Snipes's persona, from his dialogue to his wardrobe. It was based on the actor's aesthetics and martial arts skills. The new comic version has, in turn, been on par with the movie character.
Yeah. Snipes was actually originally in talks with Marvel to play Black Panther back in the late 90s, but that project fell through, and so he was offered the role of Blade instead. And he actually had no idea about Blade, like he didn't know who the character was, but he just wanted to make him cool. So that was like his big thing. Like, we got to make this guy cool. We got to make him awesome. We got to make people root for him.
And this is not to slight Snipes in the least, because I think he would have made an excellent T'Challa, but I'm glad 1998 Black Panther fell through. The technology just wasn't there to make Wakanda as awe-inspiring as it looked in 2018. And also, my inner cynic also doubts that the number of Black folks would have been involved in a 1998 production, and we would not have had the level of attention to detail of like African culture that we got 20 years later. So totally worth the wait.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And like Chadwick Boseman was so incredible as T'Challa. Like, that's just so iconic. And I'm really glad he got to play that role. So RIP Chadwick Boseman.
Wakanda forever. So we're going to break down some of the more key elements and players of the Blade film, starting with the director, Stephen Norrington. So Norrington only has 4 directing credits to his name. Death Machine, which was kind of like his auteur piece in 1994, Blade in 1998, The Last Minute in 2001, which was another one of his precious auteur films, and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen in 2003. So Norrington is actually most notable for his contributions to special effects makeup in film and television. So with credits like Aliens, Return to Oz, Gremlins, The Witches, and The Storyteller, as he worked with Jem Henson's Creature Shop. So Norrington is notoriously mercurial and difficult to work with. Like, he was actually a bully on the set of Blade, most reportedly with David Goyer.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And he got into numerous fights with Sean Connery on League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, some of which turned into actual fist fights.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I guess that explains why he did not direct the sequels to Blade.
Yeah. And well, because he wanted to move on to The Last Minute, which was like his pet project. Mm-hmm. So allegedly, like, this experience, as well as the studios trying to tell him kind of like what to do, turned him off from directing, and he's sworn it off since then. And here I thought The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen killed his directing career because it was a shit show of a movie and a big box office flop, but it turns out it was Norrington himself all along. But because like of his artist background, like the look of Blade is very tight.
Yeah. Oh, it's really good. It looks really clean. Like it's got
it looks fantastic. And, yeah. Because Norrington had such an artistic eye from his decades in like visual media. So he worked really closely with the visual effects department and the makeup department.
Nice.
In fact, speaking of which,
in Blade, there were two big special effect scenes. It's the subway sequence and then the liquefied blood animation. So the special effects producer was Richard Dr. Bailey, and he explained that the subway sequence was too dangerous and expensive to risk the safety of Wesley Snipes and also the actress who played Karen. So he and the special effects team were tasked with coming up with like these computerized trains to go whooshing through the tunnel. The set department built a partial subway tunnel in the studio, and then the fight sequence was filmed with the green screen on the set. And production bought three decommissioned subway trains to be used for the interior scenes. So they had to work with that digital train frame by frame to speed it down in an arch motion to make it look good. And I mean, given that it was 23 years ago, the subway scene looks pretty solid.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the liquefied blood animation stuff that we see, I mean, I feel there's some liquefied blood animation. There's some animation with like the heads getting big and exploding too, which I feel like doesn't look super great. But especially when Blade slices Frost's abdomen in half and then his arm like reconstitutes because he's summoned the blood god inside him so he can like put himself back together, kind of. That does not look super great. It looks very animated and cartoony. And visual effects producer Bailey only had a 3-week deadline to get that task done. And it kind of shows because, again, it just looks not that great. At the time, I don't remember it looking that great either. So I don't know if it really
looked exactly
good. Like in 98, I don't think it looked that great. So
it didn't look that great. Like, I'm unsure this would have looked good even if he had 3 months, because that liquefied animation looks, it really only does look good on like liquefied metals like we saw in Terminator 2. And that's like a film which predates Blade by like 5 years and still holds up to this day. So this effect on blood, however, I don't think it would have ever looked good, you know, like no disrespect to Doc Bailey, may he rest in peace. You know, he did what he could, you know, like on such a short notice. But yeah, it doesn't look good. So I understand also like why they went with this ending, which only showed these two very quick frames of that blood rather than like the spinning tornado.
Yeah, which I vaguely remember being really bad. I mean, the ending's not really good anyway. Bad. I mean, the ending's fine for the movie, but just like visually, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, here we go. All right.
Yeah, exactly. So there's like an example of some early CGI that worked really well, the subway scene, and then definitely did not.
Yes.
It's like someone who's just like going, it reminded me of like websites in 1998 with like, you know, the blinking GIFs with like the, remember like in, especially like the Vampire Chronicles or any sort of like vampire archive you went to, they had like the little animated dripping blood spacer bar.
Mine did not have that, but I did have a rotating like Eye of Ra that like went around in a circle.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if you remember that.
I remember that on your site. Oh my god.
Oh, I thought I was so cool. Little goth me.
I thought I was cool with the dripping blood.
Yeah. Little goth me and my Eye of Ra.
And I remember when like 3D-ish graphics were all the rage.
Yeah.
In like 2000. Oh my goodness. think Moira's Jewels or something. I don't know. She was like the hot shit of graphic design artists on the web at that time. And if you had a website that was designed by her, you were so cool and fancy.
I was just always like, I'm going to do it myself on GeoCities.
Same. Oh no, same. Absolutely. So in the practical effects department, we're going to talk about makeup. So in Blade, we're reunited with Greg Canham, who listeners will remember from The Lost Boys, because Greg designed those lenses, the vampire lenses.
Oh, cool.
So Greg initially worked with director Steve Norrington in the makeup department on Greystoke, which was like Norrington's, I think, like his very first credit in the early 80s. Canham found Blade to be a bigger opportunity for him to have another chance at a comedic horror vampires without a strict aesthetic to adhere to, as he had with Lost Boys and Dracula. So he created a range of fangs and leaned into the comic book origins, nice. Which is why none of the fangs are exactly alike. Like, you'll have some vampires with like really teeny tiny fangs and some with like comically large fangs, especially the vampires who you see up close in the blood rave scene.
Okay.
Canham is also responsible for Pearl.
Yeah, I didn't mention Pearl in the summary, but the vampire that Blade,
the archivist.
Yeah, the archivist that Blade tortures is like this vampire, and he is inexplicably extremely fat. I think we're supposed to believe that he gorges on blood and doesn't move. Vampire physiology in this movie is very weird.
We'll definitely go into Pearl and
but it's
all of the problematics. So
we will, but yeah, I just wanted to mention, because we're going to talk about him here, just who it was. So that is Pearl. Pearl is the archivist that Blade tortures to get information about the ritual.
Yeah. So Pearl was created using $7,000 worth of silicone, overall weighing around 1,500 pounds.
Oh, waste of money.
Eric Edwards played Pearl, but there were also 5 actors running the puppetry underneath. They also had to build a moving trailer on which the mold was set, and then the trailer had to be lifted with hydraulics onto the stage set to be filmed. It was a massive undertaking for being a fatphobic gag, because that's really all the character of Pearl turned out to be in the end.
Yep.
I give Canham a pass on Pearl, though, because he was designed very specifically by Stephen Norrington himself. So I'm just here talking about Greg Canham's role, which is just to make the vision happen, you know? And if this was a non-humanoid, you know, creature, like an actual creature, I'd be a lot more impressed. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, like a Jabba the Hutt kind of
thing,
or
just like a
swamp monster or something, you know, something that was not humanoid, but you know, we'll talk about Pearl later.
Yeah. So, like, I had not seen The Lost Boys before. Chell had not seen Blade before. And so this was kind of like, I'm going to watch The Lost Boys. She's going to watch Blade. We're going to discuss. So I'm curious, like, having now seen the movie for the first time, what were your thoughts?
I really liked the character of Blade himself. I thought him and Whistler were just too cool for this film, though. Like, they exude a level of quality that outshines almost everybody and everything else in the movie. Like, I thought Quinn and Mercury were superior villains, along with the surprise Vanessa reveal, and that Tracy Lord's vampire Raquel ought to have been in the film more, because she was only in that opening scene. I thought Pearl was excessively grotesque and as in bad taste, and Frost was very underwhelming for me. The aesthetics were mostly pretty cool, like the settings, Whistler's machine shop and Blade's weapons and the car. So it's a franchise I'm at least curious enough to keep watching. Like, I'm excited to watch Blade 2.
Cool. Yeah, me too. I saw Blade 2 originally. I saw Blade in theaters, and I'm pretty sure I saw Blade 2 in theaters. I don't think I've ever seen the third one, because I don't remember it, but I may have. I wouldn't like bet on that, but I think maybe that was at the time where I wasn't really watching a lot of movies because I was just busy. And so I just didn't see it and then didn't hear great things. And so I was like, skip it.
Yeah, I don't really know what was going on with me in 1998. I think 1998 was like, you know what? I was so into anime at that time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That I had, and I was so burnt out from vampires because of Anne Rice that I had no mental bandwidth to care about another vampire, because the ones I cared about were going off the deep end of crazy. So I was like, I cannot get like emotionally invested in another vampire. I've been burned, man.
No, I was definitely like, I needed to see this. I was into it. And like, anytime I could get my brothers to go see a vampire thing or something, it was like, yay. Like, or, you know, my friends, I can't remember who I saw it with. I'm sure it was probably my brother and some of our friends, like the mixture of us, my older brother, not the younger one. I don't know if he was able to go see it. But like, yeah, I remember seeing in theaters. I remember coming out of the movie, really liking it. I did at the time like Deacon Frost a little bit more than I did on this viewing, just because like, oh, vampire, rebel, whatever. I did think his plan was stupid back then, and I still think it's incredibly stupid. So that hasn't changed. But I liked the idea of him, which we'll get to. But yeah.
I think had I watched Blade when I was, let's see, 98, how old was I?
It was like 16, 17.
So I probably would have liked Deacon Frost a lot more. I probably would have been like, yeah, I'm going to root for him or something. You know, like I probably would have been way more on his side than I am now. I'm now like a jaded middle-aged lady.
Yeah, so, exactly. You know. I think I was more like, also, you know, at the time I was very into vampires. And so even though I can't remember, Buffy came out in 98 or 99, I think it was 99, but like I liked Vampire Slayer stuff. But I also just really liked vampire stories. So it was really like one of those things where it's like, yay, half vampire. But also I want to know more about the vampires in this world. Like, what's their deal? Who else, like these people who are surrounding Frost, what's their situation? Like, let's hear more about them. And we don't really get that.
Yeah, I know. Like I said, I really liked Mercury and I wanted to follow her and know way more about her than I did about Deacon.
Right.
Like, I'm like, she's fascinating, you know, because she has that like Pris is to Blade Runner as Mercury is to Blade, you know, like, so Pris is like my favorite character in Blade Runner. And she's one of the replicants. She's played by Daryl Hannah. She's very kick-ass. You know, she's just, I mean, she is a dead ringer for Mercury as well. Like, she's tall, she's leggy, she's blonde, and she kicks a lot of ass, you know? Uh-huh. And so I was just like more interested in her than I was, you know, Deacon Frost. Also, I'm a raging bisexual, so you know, I'm looking at her more than I'm looking at him.
To be fair, she's definitely, you know, more like interesting. She's prettier. I'm definitely more fascinated by her for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I just and a bitch just loves Tracy Lords. Like, I'm just like, I love everything Tracy Lords does and will ever do. So I'm just like, I'm like, put Tracy back in the movie.
And otherwise, it's one of those things where like on a TV show or movie where like someone you really like comes in the first scene and they're just never going to be back. But you're like, man,
yeah,
they're really good. I wish they were in this more.
Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about the characters more so. But yeah, I feel like I probably looked at Blade and I was probably a snotty little bitch as well, because like I was so used to like romantic philosophical vampires, you know, and like I had my special place in my heart for like Lost Boys kinds of vampires, and Blade didn't fit into like the two molds that I was familiar with.
Right.
And so I would have been going out of my comfort zone with him. And I was like, I don't get it. You know what I mean? Like, I was just this, you know, stupid kid. And I was just like, whatever, man, I'm just going to sit here and watch Yu Hakusho and fucking Fushigi Yugi. And that's just my thing. Now that is who I am. That's my personality.
I mean,
now. I'm sorry.
I also really loved Fushigi Yugi.
Oh no. I know, but you at least like could juggle your interests.
Yeah,
I had to deep dive.
If he just dangled fangs in front of me, I was like, cool, I'm in, let's do it. I'm in. Vampires, yeah. Whatever. Sweet. I did forget how sticky this movie looks. Like, oh, it looks incredibly uncomfortable to be an expert in this, especially like the blood scene with like the dance club. But even later, there's just a lot of sticky fighting going. I don't know. It just seems like it was very uncomfortable to film.
Yeah.
I agree that Pearl was fatphobic and gross and unnecessary. You could have had any kind of archivist and you didn't need to go there. I don't really understand why they went there. To me, the physiology doesn't even make sense. A similar character will appear in later seasons of Buffy. And I think he's only one or two episodes, but I think it was probably inspired by this. It's incredibly similar and it was unnecessary there too. So, you know, just steal the right things, not the gross things. Thank you. I do actually love the idea of vampires using like UV protective clothes and sunscreen to try and like outsmart their sun allergy. I thought that was really clever. And I think that's part of what I really liked about Deacon Frost when I first saw the movie is just like these attempts to get around and circumvent these vampire weaknesses by using modern technology. And yeah. I think I would like to see more of that in vampire fiction because I just think that's really fascinating to have. Like, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, it was goofy to see, but it was actually very smart.
Well, yeah, and it's just like a cool, like, just, I mean, I'm sure he's testing it on some poor vampire followers that he's like slathering in SPF 70 and throwing them outside and being like, what happens? So I'm sure that's not fun for them, but I did think that was kind of an interesting take on that. And you know, I thought that was
cool. And I think the first time I ever saw that was in Buffy when I remember watching Spike like throw his jacket over his head as he's like running to the store, to the witchy store.
And like smoking.
And he's like smoking. Yeah.
Well, and like vampires and Buffy have like the blackout stuff on their car windows. So like they can drive around during the day. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, technology exists. Use it. I think that's great.
Yeah. So let's do a character breakdown.
Yeah. So obviously we have Blade. He's a half vampire, a daywalker, and he hunts vampires. And he's a badass. I really love the character Blade. I definitely want to see him fight more bad guys and do more things. I think his motivations are very clear and, you know, I like him. I think he's well acted. He's a good character.
I mean, he's easily the most stylish and badass of all the vampire hunters that I've come across. Like, I'll always hold Christy Swanson's Buffy in my heart as the number one slayer. But I think Blade is an easy second. Like, this is no doubt due to Snipes himself and his own badassery. Like, Snipes began training in martial arts when he was 12 years old. He has a fifth degree black belt in Shotokan karate and a second degree black belt in Hapkido. He is also trained in capoeira and in a number of other disciplines, including kung fu and Brazilian jiu-jitsu and kickboxing. So during his time in New York, Snipes was trained in fighting by his friend and mentor, Brooke Ellis. So in other words, don't try to rob him. In other words, do not try to hold this man.
Don't mug Wesley Snipes. It won't end well for you.
Don't mug Wesley Snipes because he will kick your ass and you won't even know what happened. So, and being able to like watch him do all of this is amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's very well done. And like the fact that they basically molded the character around not only his aesthetic, but like his actual abilities and like the choreography was like molded around like things he could do. I think that's really sweet and it works out and it makes Blade incredibly believable and realistic and also just like cool to watch. Like it's fun to watch him.
Yeah. It's like the character of Blade gave Wesley Snipes a certain level of, I guess you could say, street cred, you know, because you know, the man is classically trained when it comes to like acting and stuff. Right. So this gave him like nerd cred. Right. But really also it was a two-way street because Wesley Snipes gave the character of Blade a lot of credit.
Yeah. Well, and I like that they kind of took him away from that blaxploitation, like green, like really bright colors and like this aesthetic that was like very 70s and made him just like badass, like black. You've got some of the leather, you've got some of the like, it just, you know, he looks like the black clothing. It looks really good.
He still had that really cool shaft panache that Blade was originally imbued with, you know, in the comics, but then he made it his own thing and it was very contemporary. So I really appreciate
it. It definitely felt like this is a modern movie. This isn't taking place in like the 60s or something, you know? So,
right.
Yeah. It looks good.
So then we have Whistler.
Yay.
Abraham Whistler. He's the older vampire hunter who found Blade as a kid and raised him and taught him the way of vampire hunting. You kind of know the wise mentor figure is going to be killed because that's a trope as old as time. But man, oh man, that did not stop me from rooting for Papa. He is the curmudgeonly loving grandpa I always wanted.
Yeah, you definitely like the grandpa thing. I mean, don't get me wrong. The grandpa in Lost Boys is also amazing, but you definitely have a soft spot for that.
I do. I love curmudgeonly old papa.
Yeah. And he's played by Kris Kristofferson. So like, obviously, like he's just really great. I do think he actually is in at least the second movie. I don't know if it's via flashbacks or how that works, but I do think he is in that movie. So he will be back.
Yeah. You know, and as much as I do love Whistler, I am unsure why the film did not go with Jamal Afari, Blade's original mentor. He was Black. And I think it would have been very touching to see like a Black father figure, mm-hmm. you know, for Blade.
I'm going to guess it's because the movie was written and created by white people and they wanted Kris Kristofferson. And so, you know,
I think that as well. But also, I mean, Jamal Afari is not without his own problematic.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Origins, because I believe of the white creators of him in that he had a struggle with drug addiction. So, and, you know, he's a jazz musician and you're just like, okay, you know, so I don't know if that kind of came into it, like where they were like, I mean, they could have just like eliminated those things, but then I guess like, is it then Jamal Afari? I don't know. So, but I don't know. It's one of those things where I like what they did, but you know, I would not have minded if Whistler had been exactly as the character he was, but played by a Black man. And don't get me wrong. I love Kris Kristofferson. Mm-hmm. He was absolutely fantastic. And I remember like watching him going, isn't Kris Kristofferson a musician?
Yes.
Because I know him as a musician. And then I forgot that he's like the male lead in the Barbara Streisand version of A Star is Born. So I was like, oh, right. Holy shit. That's like where audiences like really fell in love with him. So, and I'm like, whatever, man. I just know him from like The Highwaymen, like this, like, power country group in the 1980s. So that's all I knew him from. So I don't know if I had ever seen him act before. And I was like, holy shit, this dude's like an actor. And then I read his biography.
Yeah, he's
like
a lot
on Wiki. Oh my, this man is like Shakespearean trained fucking actor. Like he went to Oxford, England and shit. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, this country boy got, you know, made tracks around the world. But good for him.
Yeah.
So, and it's unfortunate that he's been unable to like enjoy the retrospective of Blade that has happened in the last like 10 years. Unfortunately, Kris caught Lyme disease.
Oh no.
And part of that is his memory isn't very good.
Oh, that's too bad.
It's very much too bad. So, you know, pour one out for him and, you know, hope that he gets better. He's a national treasure.
Yeah.
But yeah, Whistler's amazing. Every scene that he was in, I was just like, I could not stop watching him. I loved him so much. So, and him and Blade together, like him and Wesley Snipes, like had such great chemistry.
Yeah, no, they were great. He's great. I think they work really well as a team. I am glad to hear that he'll be in the second one again. I don't know how that works because obviously he died, but I don't know. Maybe he's a vampire. I don't know. And it's interesting that you mentioned like you wish he had been Black, because actually the character of Karen Jensen was originally supposed to be white. And I think it was like Wesley Snipes who was like, no, let's hire.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's cool.
Yeah. And she is. She's such a strong, I think, understated Black woman. Like I don't hear a whole lot of people when they recall like strong Black women, smart and clever Black women in film. I don't hear Karen Jensen's name come up.
No, but she's incredibly resourceful. Like she manages to create both a vampire weapon and a serum to save herself and eventually a better serum for Blade. And she also manages to get out of a pit by using just the tools. Like she's a bone to like claw her way up. Like she's very resourceful and smart. So she is obviously the hematologist who found the strange discrepancies on some of the corpses. And obviously Quentin comes back, bites her, and she thinks it's game over for a while. She's played by Anne Boucher Wright, who started her career as a dancer before switching to acting. I do tend to not be a fan of having too much science in my fantasy. Like sometimes I think that line can get blurred and I'm kind of like, don't need it. But I do really love when people figure out supernatural things through their job or something. Like, I feel like it's really fun when they like are just doing like the routine job that they do, like delivering mail or looking at blood through a microscope. And they're like, wait a minute, this is weird. Yeah. So I thought that was cool. I liked that a lot. And I do think she's a solid character. I am sad she doesn't appear in the Blade sequels. I'm not really sure why. I guess because her story is finished and complete and she doesn't need to be there, but it would have been cool if she had continued to be.
Yeah, and nothing like bad happens to her character. Like she gets mentioned, I think, in Blade 2, like for helping out with like the serum and stuff. But yeah, she just, you know, she had other ways to go.
Yeah, her
you
story know?
And
arc
it's funny
done,
because like
yeah.
she's set up as like a love interest, you know, like the girlfriend archetype. And so you're totally expecting them to hook up and they do have chemistry. But yeah, ultimately, like their missions in life are of greater importance than like romance. Like, you know, he's on a mission to be hunting down vampires and she's a fucking doctor doing doctor shit. So she's a hematologist, man, you know, so she's fighting the good fight through her job. So I think that's cool. And I think that's very realistic. And it's not like, you know, now she's just some chick who follows him around.
Yeah,
you
that's know? True. That is good.
No disrespect to any chick who does just, you know, follow around the hero or nothing. It's just that that trope's been done and to death. So I'm glad that Dr. Karen Jensen is still doctoring, you know.
Still doing but
yeah,
science.
No, science. She's doing science, man. She's a scientist. But I was initially underwhelmed by the character, like when she was first introduced, but then I was like, no. She's like, and then as she got more and more clever, I was like, oh my God, she's like the best Doctor Who companion who was never on Doctor Who. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm like, holy crap. Like, look at her. How like resourceful, like, Blade, you should be so much nicer than you are right now to her, because he's, you know, he's a bit
he's a little salty to people. Yeah,
he's salty. Yeah, he's salty boy. And you know, they have like words that they exchange at times and stuff, but yeah, she's just, I don't know, she's just really cool and she's very strong. And the fact that like he did put his foot down and was like, nah, she's got to be black, was awesome.
Yeah, for sure. And then we have Deacon Frost, who's a modern, quote unquote, modern vampire who's tired of purebloods making the rules, and he thinks technology will be his savior. So he plans to awaken a blood god and rule the vampires. And
which is weird and kind of like the complete antithesis to technology, but
yeah,
you know, whatever.
Yeah. And like the character in the comics is a lot older. And obviously when he's that doctor who infects Blade's mom, I mean, he's like a middle-aged dude and they decided to go with someone younger. He's played by Stephen Dorff, who was apparently a huge Lost Boys fan as a kid. So he was really excited to play this role.
Fun fact though, he totally thought that this role was going to destroy his career.
Yeah. Well, just because he thought like,
he's like, ooh, I'm in this goofy film. And I'm like, boy, I have never seen you in a single film in my life other than this.
I think I've seen him in like some I looked at his IMDb page. I can't remember anything specific. I think there were one or two things where I was like, oh, I think I've seen that. But yeah, this is what I know him from. So this is it.
Yeah.
Sorry, Steven. This is all I know you from.
Yeah.
The role was actually originally offered to Jet Li, which would have made this a much different movie.
He probably would have been a better villain, but Jet Li took on the villain role of Wasing Ku in Lethal Weapon 4, which was also released in 1998.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the way the character is written, I don't know if the villain would have been that much better. Like if he still had the same plan and everything, I think it still would have been like meh. So
yeah,
would have been interesting to see him, but I don't know how.
Well, when they cast Stephen Dorff, they like leaned hard into that like Bret Easton Ellis archetype of modern white man, you know, yuppie scum.
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, when I first watched the movie, I remember liking Dorff's character a lot more. I liked Deacon Frost. I didn't love him. I didn't think he was like the greatest vampire character ever. I just appreciated the perspective, right? From a 2021 perspective, though, he really does feel like this douchey rich tech bro who thinks he's found a way to reinvent transportation, but really just keeps reinventing the bus. Like, that's really entirely what he felt like to me in this movie. So obviously I'm older and jaded. I do think the character had a lot of potential, and I love the vampire trope of the vampire who's like, screw your politics in the old ways. It's the modern age. I'm doing this vampire stuff my way. I'm going to vampire the way I want. But I just think his plan to awaken an ancient blood god and then vampirize the world is just like not a good plan. And also just like, even if I were a vampire, I don't think I'd be super on board with that, because I feel like the world would just kind of be boring if everyone was a vampire. So I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So you and I had complained about the fact that there was a supply and demand issue, because like, who are you going to eat if all the humans are vampires? But you found the deleted scene that explains.
Well, this. I didn't. Yeah. So there is a deleted scene that explains that apparently Frost had this plan to make human farms to harvest blood. So it wasn't going to turn, because when he explains the plan in the movie, it's like everyone will become a vampire, kind of like the blood god is just going to like take over the world and all of a sudden everyone's going to be turned. And I'm like, that's not going to work out well for anyone. But apparently they cut the scene where he explained that obviously there would be some humans kept in these blood farms. And so,
yeah, they're like, he like shows Karen the prototype in like this deep freezer he has of like these human blood bags.
Yeah. But I mean, again, just think about being a vampire in that world where everyone else is a vampire. Like that just seems like not fun. I don't know. I just, there's an episode of Buffy too, where it's like doppelganger land, where like most of the Scooby gang are like vampires, and like Willow gets like, Willow's vampire gets transported into Buffy's world. It's really fun. It's a fun episode. I really love it. But I just think, man, that world would be so boring, because like pretty much everyone's a vampire, and just, I don't know, not that fun anymore. Yeah.
I feel like Deacon had potential, but was directed incorrectly and given the worst vampire overlord look ever. Like, I could not take him seriously, even for 5 seconds. He looked like Derek Zoolander's twin.
Yeah.
Literally, the only other credit to Stephen Dorff that I've seen is The Gate. So I'm not going to say it was cast incorrectly. More like written, directed, and given a shit show of a look. I just, yeah, every time he opened his mouth, I was just like, try not to laugh. Yeah. Because I was like, I can't follow your logic, boy.
Well, and I don't think the plan is very logical anyway. So that's fair.
I mean, you know, and by contrast, Mercury, played by Spanish actress Arlie Javier, looked amazing. Very simple, but chic. Effective, but still very modern. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And she was more interesting with saying less than he was the more he talked.
Yeah, well, and I'm like, I get it, but the plan, again, it just, I mean, I know he's not the star of the movie, so we don't really, I mean, the villain plan doesn't have to be good, right? It just needs to be something Blade can defeat. But it just is so, I'm just sitting there going like, I want to root for you, buddy. I want to, but your plan is just
couldn't believe
bad.
How ineffective the Vampire Council was.
Yeah,
like
I have
Dragonetti.
I have a whole thing
I'm
about
like,
that.
What the fuck? Like, you guys are just like sitting around,
yeah,
talking shop in your sharp suits. I'm like, you guys are so much more powerful than him. Like, what is wrong? But then again, I guess there is power in numbers, though. And because Deacon has been turning so many vampires, he has a much bigger follower count. So he's like that one annoying YouTuber who has like super annoying fan base, and he keeps starting drama with older, more established, less dramatic YouTubers, and then he sticks like his little army fan base on them. they put rude comments on their every single video. That's like the modern interpretation of what I watched between that.
Yeah, I don't really. Yeah, I don't follow YouTubers enough to know that. But yeah, that sounds about right.
And then we have Quinn, Deacon's right-hand man, pun intended, who attacks Dr. Jensen after he's fried to a crisp, but not dead. And Quinn is one of the best characters because he's just such a dumbass party boy who is just looking for a good time. And Donald Loge, it has always been a favorite of mine. And I laughed wholeheartedly when I first spotted him in this film. Like, I would have rather him be the seeming big bad before Vanessa is revealed along with Mercury.
Yeah, I just don't think his character works as the big bad. So I don't know if that would have worked, but like,
sure.
Do think he's really great. And I do think he works really well as like the pathetic right-hand guy who like, for whatever reason, keeps doing what Frost says. That's another question I have about these vampires. Like, why are they following him? Do they have to? Cause it just like, he keeps doing horrible things to this character. Like his hand gets blown off and then it grows back. And then Frost is like threatening to cut it off. It just, yeah, I don't know. Doesn't seem like you want to follow Deacon Frost. Doesn't seem like it'd be good for you, but you know. But yeah, Quinn is great. He's really fun. And then we have Vanessa, who is Blade's mother, now a vampire, who we learn was attacked and killed by Deacon Frost and therefore turned by Deacon Frost.
Vanessa was an excellent twist, but I don't think that this film properly set up that once turned, vampires are totally disconnected from their mortal past. Like, I kept expecting her to turn on Deacon and help her son out, having played the long game all these years. Like, I would have liked that.
Yeah.
However, I mean, it is cool that she is, like, totally villainized. It's just that, like I said, they didn't establish that you are 100% disconnected to your mortal feelings.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't really, and to be fair, like, again, they don't have a lot of time to establish how vampires work, because it's, you know, they establish some of the basics, but yeah, that is one of the ones where it's like, okay, it's kind of, I also expected her to help him instead of, like, strap him in. And I'd seen the movie before a very long time ago, but I kept waiting for her to, like, come unlock him. I forgot that it was Karen that helped him. So I think that's just something that, like, I don't know. But then you're like, I guess at that point, then when she dies, you're not like, oh, you know, sad about it because she was evil. I do think the reveal worked, and I like that it wasn't overly done. Like, Blade is definitely surprised that she's alive and surprised to learn that Frost was her attacker, but it didn't, like, send him into some kind of existential spiral or anything where it was like, where it could have just gone really bad. And so it was more like, well, fuck, that happened. And then it moved on. So I thought that was well done.
Yeah, he was able to compartmentalize.
Yeah, didn't totally destroy him. I mean, it definitely put him in that dark moment a little bit quicker, but still it wasn't like, oh.
Yeah. So then we have Pearl, the archivist for the House of Erebus. The saddest part is Pearl would have been a fascinating character had the director not designed him to be a fatphobic gag. Pearl's role is actually very vital to Frost's success, as he translated the lost pages of Erebus for him, undermining the rest of the council. The reason Norrington gives for Pearl's excessiveness is that he had, quote, cannibalistic lust for infants and children, and he loves to eat their hearts, end quote. But that doesn't really make sense. Like, he isn't a cannibal if he is a whole other species, unless he ate kids before becoming a vampire. So vampires stay as they are upon death, but I guess if he was a pure blood and therefore born, weight gain happens, question mark? Either way, it's gross because there are a lot of red flag messages with this character. Like, the children part, I'm just like, what are you trying to say?
Well, and
like, it's all around just like a terrible character.
Well, and it doesn't add anything. It just gives him more surface area for Blade to, like, attack, I guess. There's no purpose for it because he's not anywhere else in the movie. So we don't need that. It could have just been any vampire sitting in the archive. It didn't need to be this fatphobic joke.
Right.
So it just was totally unnecessary and didn't add anything to the movie and could easily be removed and replaced with just a normal actor of any size, just being themselves without being gross about it. And it would have worked fine.
Yeah.
So also apparently it was very expensive to do that and there was no point.
Right.
So now we're going to talk about some of the popular vampire tropes that appear in Blade. First is obviously familiars. So in Blade, they're mortals who are fiercely loyal to a vampire master, hoping that if they do enough to impress the vampire, they'll be turned. So vampire familiars fall under the umbrella of what TV Tropes calls vampire wannabes, which is people who want to be turned into vampires. I'm going to argue that familiars are just a subset of those, because there are a lot of characters in vampire media and vampire fiction that want to be vampires, but aren't actually familiars. I feel like familiars are people who actively work for a vampire in exchange for hopefully becoming a vampire themselves. So I'm not going to count, like, fangbangers from Suki Stackhouse, because unless one of them is actually working for Eric hoping to become a vampire, they don't really count as a familiar.
Right, right.
Yeah. So that's my criteria for what a familiar is. It's not just someone who wants to be a vampire. You have to actively be working for a vampire to achieve that goal. The idea of familiars began with Renfield from Dracula. Renfield in Dracula is a patient at an insane asylum, and he's likely driven there by his encounters with Dracula. And Dracula comes to him and promises that if Renfield worships him, he'll make Renfield immortal by providing him with an endless source of rats and insects, because Renfield believes that blood is the key to eternal life. Notably, Dracula doesn't really promise to turn him into a vampire, though. So it's kind of... Renfield does do Dracula's bidding, but eventually has a crisis of conscience and eventually fights against him. So that's kind of where this trope sort of started. Obviously, one of the biggest examples is going to be Guillermo from What We Do in the Shadows. Because in the TV show, What We Do in the Shadows, Guillermo has worked for Nandor for over 10 years in hopes of being a vampire. That is literally why he is working for him. And so we follow his journey on the show, wishing that Nandor would make him a vampire, never quite getting what he wants. It's very sad. The other notable example is kind of a half example. If you've seen Buffy, there's an episode called Lie to Me, where a character named Ford, who's an old friend of Buffy's, arrives in Sunnydale from Los Angeles. He actually knows she's the Slayer because of what he witnessed in LA. So apparently when she like burned down the gym or something, he saw some vampire action, figured out what she was. So he finds Spike and he promises to deliver the Slayer to him if Spike will agree to turn Ford into a vampire. So he's kind of working for him. Spike is more like, sure, whatever. He doesn't really seem to like make that explicit promise, but is good enough for Ford, I guess. So Ford lures Buffy into a trap along with a bunch of vampire wannabes because they're there as fodder for the vampire. So they think they're all going to get turned into vampires, but really Ford's plan is to let the vampires feed on them and then turn him. Buffy, while they're trapped in this place, pleads with Ford to let the others go. And then she learns that Ford is actually dying of cancer, hence his desperation to be turned and be immortal. And obviously that doesn't make murder okay. So cool motive, still murder, basically. Spike and Drew arrive with their vampire crew, but Buffy gets the drop on Drew. And so Spike allows everyone to escape, including Buffy, except Ford, who gets locked inside with the vampires. He's then bitten in turn, but Buffy stakes him as soon as he wakes up and comes out of his grave. So it doesn't work out well for him. So he's kind of a familiar because he's trying to work for Spike to be a vampire, but he's not like in an explicit contract for that. Whereas in Blade,
sure,
the familiars are actively like, I'm loyal to you and I'll fight to the death for you. But my
goal is because you have the one who attacks Karen, who's a cop. So then we have Born This Way. Some vampires, quote unquote, purebloods are born while others are turned. I think a class system within vampire society is very clever and underutilized by film and TV. I think it's more of a vampire book trope because it can be properly explored and dismantled like over a series.
Yeah, it's hard to do in a quick spurt because it's just a lot. I do think that purebloods versus turned humans is a fascinating concept. Like I said, I don't think it's explored too much here. And like you said earlier, I would have liked to see more aggression or power from the purebloods to help explain or justify Frost's stupid plan because like you said, they don't do anything. So they just kind of let him threaten them and then he kills one of them and like pulls out their fangs and it's just like, drops the fangs on the table and is like, I'm in charge now. And they just, you know, they let themselves be herded into this place where the ritual is going to take place and be killed. Like, it just seems like they're completely ineffectual and useless, sort of like the Democrats, where they just don't do anything to help themselves. And so, yeah, they seem totally powerless. And I feel like maybe if like at the beginning in that meeting, they had marched some of the people Frost had turned into the meeting room and like executed them or something, and said, look, we're going to do this to everyone you turn if you don't, whatever, or just some actual threat, because I feel like otherwise his motivation doesn't make as much sense because he doesn't really have anything to be fighting against because they don't seem to do very much.
Yeah. Like, I don't. Yeah, I'm like, why are you guys ineffectual?
Well, and it's just like, yeah, they're sitting around, they're doing nothing. They're just kind of. They have a little council where they sit and have their council meetings, but they seem pretty useless overall. So like, I don't know.
Right. I don't know. I think they should have definitely
maybe
extrapolated on that or explained it a little bit more.
Yeah. Or at least had some showing of how they're suppressing Frost and the human vampires in some way, keeping them down so that Frost has something worth fighting against other than I just want to be a blood god and turn everybody, which right. Yeah. Anyway. So just a couple examples in Kim Harrison's The Hollow series, there are lowborn vampires, quote unquote, who are humans who have been turned by an undead vampire. There are also people who've been bitten who are like in a different class because they're not yet vampires. And then there are highborn vampires who are born, and then when they die, they rise and become undead vampires, and then they get like the full range of vampire powers. I have to say, I've only read the first book of the series, and it's not really my thing. It's just one of those things where, you know, some books you're really into, some you don't really get into. This one, it didn't click with me. But she does have a really interesting vampire mythology, and the series is very world-building heavy. So if you're into urban fantasy with like really intense world-building, you might really like that series. And then in Vampire Academy, Moroi vampires are born. They do have to drink blood, and sunlight weakens them. They also have like an elemental magic, like some have like water magic, some have fire magic. And then the Strigoi are like the undead vampires who are turned. So they could have either been human previously, or they could have been Moroi. Kind of could be either way.
And then we have the daywalking half vampire, also called
Dampiers. And so again, in Vampire Academy, half vampires are Dampiers, and they can actually be out in sunlight without issue, where vampires cannot. In that world, Moroi can like get weakened by the sunlight, but the Strigoi, the evil vampires, do like ignite and burn in the sunlight. And Dampiers in that world also don't need to drink blood, and they don't have fangs, but they are pretty strong. They're kind of badasses. So kind of a good trade-off.
And then we have in Vampire Hunter D, D is a half vampire whose parents are a vampire and a human. He has the best of both worlds and none of the weaknesses, much like Blade, and can also walk around in sunlight.
Yep. And he hunts vampires. So, you know, pretty cool. And then we have cures for vampirism, which is another popular trope. Obviously, there's Blade serum, which is a cure for his bloodlust. And then Karen's cure for the newly bitten. So if you've been bitten, you can be cured. It's obviously something that happens a lot in vampire media and urban fantasy, so can't possibly cover them all, but we do have a couple examples. I literally wrote a whole trilogy about this because I was annoyed at like the trend in urban fantasy. I think it was kind of like a Twilight backlash thing where there was a bunch of like really pro vampire books, and then it kind of spun around and everyone in like urban fantasy was like, "Ooh, vampires are gross," and like, "I wouldn't want to be a vampire and vampires are icky," and I was like, "Oh, I don't relate to that." So in the series, it's called the Henry Dunn series. It's an urban fantasy series. Henry is cured by her friend, who's a scientist, who had been making a cure for her vampire girlfriend, but her vampire girlfriend gave up before it was ready. And then she just infects Henry with it against her will. Like, Henry doesn't know what's happening, and she gets turned human again, and she's pretty pissed off about it. And then she basically spends 3 books trying to become a vampire again, but none of the vampires will touch her because now her blood is tainted. And she has to deal with murders and vampire politics. And like I said, it was just kind of a direct response to the trope of vampires being seen as gross or wanting cures and hating themselves. So hashtag team vampire.
Vampire Diaries utilizes a vampire cure too. In that show, there was only enough for one person, and apparently Elena force feeds it to Catherine, thus curing her.
Yeah, I've only seen a few episodes, so I know who Elena is, but I think Catherine is Stefan Sire. I only watched a couple episodes.
I think so too. And I think the same actress who plays Elena also plays Catherine.
I think so, because they look alike, right? That's the thing.
They look alike because I don't know if like she's her. Well, she's not obviously reincarnated because I think there's some mystic reason for that. But yeah, whatever.
I think so too. And then in season 6 of Supernatural, there's an episode called Live Free or Twie Hard, where Dean Winchester is bitten by a vampire. And Sam actually knows that there is a cure, but the cure only works if you haven't had a single drop of blood. So you can't give in at all. You can't like drink any human blood or you're screwed. I think it might be all blood, to be honest. Dean manages to resist the urge and is cured at the end of the episode. This is kind of their lull Twilight episode because it was at the time when Twilight was very popular. And the episode is basically about vampires using the popularity of vampire teen romance books to lure people in, like to lure these girls in, because they're like, "Oh, I want to date a vampire. It's so romantic." And then they would like attack them. So that is kind of the premise for that. And Dean was chosen for his looks because he would be good bait for that, I guess. I don't know.
In the animated film Batman versus Dracula, Batman finds a cure for vampirism, but it won't work on Dracula himself, just on people Dracula has turned.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's Forever Night. Nick Knight, the main character, is like a 900-year-old vampire who works as a cop in Toronto, and he catches bad guys and drinks blood from wine bottles. And he's always hoping to find a way to become human again. So he is seeking a cure actively. I don't think it ever happens, but I honestly don't remember the end of the show. So maybe, I don't know. And then obviously we have vampire hunters. And I'm just going to say, stay tuned, because our next episode is going to be all about vampire hunters. So we will talk about that in depth next time.
And then we have the wise mentor slash father figure. So in Blade, we have Abraham Whistler, a grizzled, cantankerous teddy bear who found Blade when he was but a teenager feeding off of the homeless. He brought him up and taught him a better way.
Yep. And another obvious example of this trope is Giles in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Giles obviously is not old, because I think he's in his late 20s, early 30s or something. I don't think he's that old, but like to teenagers, he seems old. And when I was a teenager, I was like, oh yeah, Giles is an old dude. And he's not only a mentor to Buffy, but he's also a father figure as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, Giles is the best. I really do love him.
So now we're just going to kind of talk about random Blade trivia and facts.
Yeah, so now we're just going to kind of talk about the movie a little bit. Anything else we maybe haven't said yet?
Yeah. This is where all of our little random thoughts go into. So I love that David Goyer, who wrote the script, called the vampires heroin chic scumbags. I think that describes them beautifully, and wrote them deliberately to not be romantic figures, and that there is nothing attractive about like living forever. Like, they aren't hideous Nosferatu monsters, but more like trashy white collar gangsters. And in the video essay Cult of Blade, all of these various talking heads philosophize vampires and vampirism. So you got everybody in this clown car. A Catholic friar, Mick Farren, who's like an English journalist, a folklorist, and an assistant professor at the UCLA School of Medicine, authors, some New Line Cinema monkey executive, David Goyer, and even Gordon Melton, author of the Vampire Encyclopedia, who had the most scathing remarks and backhanded compliment on Blade. I quote, Blade is much less sophisticated philosophically than some of the other movies that have played to vampirism as an addiction model or some deep psychological need. It's a good action flick. And I think David Goyer summed up Blade best. You just have to be very mindful of who are you making this movie for and what do you need to make sure you deliver on. And for Blade, what you need to make sure you deliver on is kicking ass.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've read lots of articles about Blade in research for this episode. And a lot of the people making this movie thought of it as a Marvel superhero movie, which it is, not a vampire movie. And I think that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I get bored with the whole like vampirism is a metaphor for addiction, because I think that's just, it's done to death. And the morality of mankind and being a monster or whatever. I don't know. I mean, sometimes a good story is just a good entertaining story, and it doesn't always have to be that deep. So I agree. Sometimes kicking ass.
And it's funny because like in one of the most probably beautiful and top tier vampire films there is Only Lovers Left Alive.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't, and I love it because there is no moral quandary over vampirism. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, they do get a little stifled, like Adam, especially, like he gets a bit bored with immortality, but he's not apologetic about who he is. And I certainly does not come off as like self-loathing or anything like that, you know? And there's no like addiction allegory. Like, it's just a beautiful film about beautiful creatures. And it has a lot of substance though to that simple premise, you know? So yeah,
it doesn't always have to be about, and you know, that's fine. There's a place for those stories for sure. It's just that not every vampire story has to be like exploring whether it's right to kill to survive or exploring addiction through bloodlust or whatever it is. It's like, it doesn't need to be that way all the time. Sometimes it's just a fun vampire story. Let's just have a good time, guys. Let's just have a good time.
Have a good time.
Come on. So just some cultural influence on other vampire stuff. I'm sure there's a lot of things that Blade has inspired, so I'm not going to say this is a comprehensive list. I just wanted to mention What We Do in the Shadows again, because in the first season of What We Do in the Shadows, there's like a vampire council meeting where they bring in actors who have played vampires from all sorts of vampire properties, including Only Lovers Left Alive, and they just have them in the room as the actors, as if the actors are the vampires, which I thought was really funny. And so they have
really funny.
Yeah. And then they even mentioned like, oh, Brad and Tom couldn't make it or whatever. So, you know, just really, it was good. And then they have Wesley Snipes, and he appears on a video call as Wesley the Daywalker. And so he's part of the Vampire Council. And then in season three, Donald Logue, who plays Quinn, actually shows up in the show and he plays himself. And he says that playing a vampire made him really dig the lifestyle. So he became a vampire as well. So I thought that was really fun. So Blade, it was fun because we had actually just watched Blade right before that episode aired. And so I was like, oh my gosh, it's Quinn. Like, I thought that was really good. It was kind of a great vampire reference. So good times.
So now we're going to jump back to talk about Blade in more recent comics. In 2015, a new Blade series was announced. It would have found the vampire hunter teaming up with his estranged daughter to fight vampires. Set to be released from writer Tim Seeley, Seeley stepped down after coming to the conclusion that there didn't need to be another white team on a black-led book and suggested that a black woman would do a better job than he could. Good for you, Seeley.
Yeah, I think it's really great that he finally, because at that time there was a lot of reckoning around like, why are all these characters of color being written by white people all the time? And so I'm glad that he kind of realized, hey, maybe someone else should take over, possibly a black woman. Marvel, maybe get on that.
Yeah. And although Seeley's decision was admirable, Marvel has yet to take his advice. Marvel did release an issue of their Darkhold comic in October of 2021 featuring Blade, where Blade has become a monster.
Yeah, I think so. I believe that that is the Darkhold thing where like Blade is a vampire presiding over a world of vampires because it's like a different world. But it was written by Daniel Kibblesmith, who's also a white dude. So nothing against him. It's just that Marvel clearly did not take his advice. And obviously that's not like a full run of Blade or anything. It's just like an AU one shot type deal. But yeah.
Blade currently pops up in conjunction with other comics, most notably Avengers, Immortal Hulk, and Spider-Man. Given the oncoming storm of Blade in the MCU, though, I would not doubt that a fresh set of Blade comics is coming forthwith. There's nothing that's been announced, but I'm pretty confident next year we're going to get a lot of Blade news.
Yeah, I think so, too. So then we have the sequels, and we're probably going to do future episodes on these, at least for Blade 2, possibly Blade 3, we'll see. So we're not really going to go into them here, but I just want to briefly mention them. There is Blade 2, which was directed by Guillermo del Toro, which is interesting, and written by David S. Goyer, who also wrote the first one. And then Blade Trinity was written and directed by David S. Goyer, and apparently features Ryan Reynolds. And again, I don't remember if I've seen that movie, so I do not know how that works.
I've seen bits of it on TV with commercials. There you go. So there you go.
And at one point, Stephen Dorff actually said that they had wanted to make a $20 to $30 million prequel with Deacon Frost, which would have been a gangster vampire movie set in New York City. And that he thought that would have been awesome. But apparently there was too much drama between New Line and Marvel about who owned the rights to the character. So that project never got off the ground. I would have eaten that shit up in like 2000. Right. I would have been all over it. So if they had made that, I would have been into it. But alas.
So, big spoilers for the Eternals in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So, just fair warning for the next, like, I don't know, 2 minutes.
Yeah, just hit that forward button, I guess, for the next 30 seconds.
Hit that forward button. So, in July of 2019, Marvel announced Mahershala Ali had been cast as Blade. During the post-end-credit scene, the voice of Ali as Blade is heard speaking to Dane Whitman as he is about to wield the ebony blade. He says, "Are you sure you're ready for that, Mr. Whitman? It's a promise of big things to come for our favorite Dampier."
Yeah. So apparently Marvel was going to start filming the new Blade reboot and then COVID hit. And so it's been pushed to 2022. So 2022 is actually only in like a month and a half now, which doesn't sound right to my brain, but yeah, that's true. And Wesley Snipes is not going to be involved. He's actually, from what I have read, pretty salty about that.
Oh.
He's not exactly happy that he's not being involved. I'm glad they recast Blade, not because Blade, Wesley Snipes is too old to do it, but just because it's kind of nice to hand it off to someone else, I think.
Yeah.
But also apparently, and I didn't mention this earlier because I don't know much about it, but there were some allegations that Wesley Snipes as well was kind of not very nice on the set of Blade Trinity. He denies bad behavior, but there are some reports that maybe he was not super great to work with. Possibly some harassment allegations. I did not look into it, so I really don't know, but I just, that might be part of why they're moving on and recasting the role, for anyone curious.
Well, and Wesley's had some issues as of late, which we're just not
going to not even going to get into it, because it's just, that's not what this podcast is about. This podcast is about vampires, not actors. So, which isn't to say that any of those allegations or things that people have said about him aren't true. It's just that I don't know even what the allegations are or who made them, and it's not something we're going to get into. But so yeah, that was our discussion of Blade. I don't think I have any other thoughts. I think we pretty much covered it. What about you?
No, I don't have any other thoughts.
All right. You're thoughtless.
I am thoughtless now. The vampire question of the episode is, what's your favorite line from any Blade movie? Be sure to share with us on Twitter or Instagram.
And links for those will be in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Vampires Ruined My Life.
This is Tori and Chell wishing you a fangtabulous evening with vampire wishes and baddie nightmares.
Your hostesses through the everlasting darkness have been Tori and Chell.
Our music is mixed by Vic Raw, the Never Living, and includes Dark Halloween Night by Chase Allen Willis and Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach and performed by Kevin MacLeod.
Find us at anchor.com/vampires ruined my life or wherever you listen to podcasts.